I've always wanted to work with my people. And coming from a family that's had strong voices across Aboriginal issues, political areas, you know, advocacy, always. So I've come from a family that has taught us to look people in the eye and say what you need to. Be respectful, but say what you need to. I think learning from watching my uncles and aunties going through those sorts of things, and my grandfather and grandmother, just everybody in my family, I've been fortunate enough to have strong role models. There was no option to just say no, because I've always, like I said, I've always wanted to not save the world, because who can save the world, but just be another voice.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. For episode 5, we meet Janine Glidden. A proud Budimaya, Yamaging Nyalu and Balladong Noongar Yoga, Janine was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2022, recognised for her continued advocacy in the Aboriginal health sector. After working across various state government areas, Janine found her long-time position in health with a particular focus on supporting Aboriginal mothers birthing off country. Her work is deeply connected to culture and caring for women alike. And despite what she might tell you, Janine is a fierce Aboriginal researcher too. It's Season 2, Episode 5 of Herstory with Janine Glidden. This is her story.
A buddy, my Balladong woman.
Who's busy.
Who's, yeah. Very busy.
Good.
But it's all good.
We'll get started then, Janine. Let's talk a little bit about childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town called Perenjori. It's about 4-hour drive north on the inland road. So it's sort of classed like the Wheat Belt. We called it the Wheat Belt, but that seems to be owned by the Northerns and all that sort of area. That's where I grew up, but I was actually born at King Edward Hospital in Perth, which is a significant birthing site for Aboriginal women.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, first 12 years was in the country. It's what I still call home, because that's the part that you really embed or gets embedded in you. And then since I was 12, yeah, I've grown up here on Noongar Boodja.
Tell me a bit about your family growing up. Were you a really close family? Do you have lots of siblings?
I'm the oldest of three. I've got two younger brothers. My mum comes from a family of 8 and my dad comes from a family of 8. Very close to my mum's side of the family, because that's where Dad relocated to or moved to.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, always been very close, very strong. Unfortunately, you know, as we do in life, you have siblings that pass on as you're getting older, but I'm very blessed to still have my mother and father, 74 and 76. And now we've got 4 generations, first time in our... Yeah, so I've got a grandson, which now mum and dad are enjoying.
For folks who maybe don't understand the significance of that, can you explain why that's important, why the 4 generations is a big deal?
Because, as a lot of people would know, or maybe not, that Aboriginal people have not had long lives.
Mm.
You know, closing the gap means is that we have shorter lives than non-Aboriginal people. So it's usually that 15 to 20 years behind. So if you can reach your 60s, you're doing well. Because unfortunately, yeah, we don't. But we do have a lot of older people living, so it's pretty awesome. They're our storytellers.
I have a feeling today we're going to learn a lot about that through this conversation. You mentioned there about being born at King Edward Memorial Hospital, and that's going to come up a lot today as well. Can you remember, obviously not being born, but your first interactions with the medical world and being an Aboriginal person accessing medical help?
It's right from when you're a child, I guess, you know, having to do all your immunisations and things like that. But as you know, in the small country towns and that, the services are very limited. And going back, you know, a young 50-odd years ago, I'm saying young, you know, it was different back then to what it is now. Unfortunately, in some areas, it's not progressed in a lot of spaces around accessing services or culturally safe services for Aboriginal people. But coming to Perth, the reason why we relocated was for medical reasons for my father at the time. So it's been a difficult area to hope that you are going to get the same quality services as everybody else, but unfortunately those services are not there yet.
When you say culturally safe access, what does that mean?
That can mean so many different things to different people, but for me it's about acknowledging Aboriginal people into the services, which people might think is an automatic, but if an Aboriginal person walks into a predominantly non-Aboriginal service and the clients in that are non-Aboriginal, there's no one familiar. So you're a little bit, you know, like you're not comfortable. And are they, have they even met Aboriginal people? You know, so you wonder if they understand or how you can relate to them and trust that you can give your information to them. So you can do things like, you know, having resources, the Aboriginal flag and the Torres Strait Islander flag, you know, something to indicate that you are a supporter and you understand and you're wanting to be a part of that closer gap.
Did you notice this when you moved here? You really catered for your dad's health. Is that something that you were able to notice that wasn't happening? Or did you realise, like, it is a bit different coming here country and maybe not having those acknowledgements that are necessary?
So growing up in the country, I never really, or I don't think our family that I can remember ever used the word Aboriginal or Indigenous. It was always by our language group or the region, which was Yamaji. And that's all I knew I was. I was Yamaji. And when we came to Perth and we had to start going to school and things like that, these words Aboriginal and Indigenous was coming. But at the same time, when I started school, they were still calling us Kortakas, 116th, 132. I didn't even know how they come about with all those sorts of things.
I don't think I've ever heard some of those before.
Yeah, right. And previously in my grandfather and grandmother's era, it was quadroon, all those sort of very derogatory measurements. I don't know how they come up with measurements of blood, and we all bleed red. But that was the thing for me, is like the focus was on you're Aboriginal. And I'm like, well, I'm Yamaji, you know. Coming to school in Perth because of my fair skin, because my father is non-Aboriginal, my mother had to prove that I was Aboriginal with the principal of the primary school, because you could get certain resources and things like that for Aboriginal people. But because I didn't have a recognised last name that was possibly Aboriginal, or, and I looked fair and Mum looked fair, so she's like, what do you want me to do? Bring my parents down to show you? You know, so that was the start of differences we were noticing.
It's interesting because there's a couple of things there, right? The idea of a mixed marriage, and I say that in inverted commas because it's just people getting married and then having children. To ask somebody to prove their ethnicity in any way, it's shocking, right? And then it's that question of, well, how do you actually do that? Because I'm Yamaji, because that's just where I came from.
Yeah, just instead of taking their word for it, you had to have a certain look, I guess. A certain coloured skin, or that stereotypical thing of, you know, broad noses and all that sort of rubbish. Sorry, but that's just, it's just not, you know, and that's something that I've had to probably deal with most of my life.
You can understand why maybe there is a distrust amongst First Nations people of health or other institutes as well.
Yeah. I think the town that we came from, I didn't feel any racism or anything there. I had a lot of friends, but I think the thing with us as Aboriginal people is that our first friends are our brothers and sisters and our cousin sisters and brothers. Like, we don't need to go outside of our family because we have so many to be able to be friends with and be at home with. So that was your security blanket. But when you come to Perth and you have to separate from your family members and that, you have to find new friends.
So that's a theme that's clearly run through your life and through your career as well, your career that spanned decades. Let's jump ahead a little bit now. When you finish school, what's the next thing that you do?
When I finished high school, I went and did a secretarial course at Edwards. I think everyone in those days was either a hairdresser, going to nursing, or being a type of secretary. Yeah, that was something that I went and did. and probably trying to get in. Back in those days, it was always important to try and get yourself a government job because it was safe. You're never going to get sacked. It was permanent. It was just the be-all and end-all in those days is, oh, gosh, you've got a government job. That's awesome, you know. But even talking about my life lately and looking at those sorts of things, the start of my career in the public service back then, we could do a test. They had Aboriginal-specific testing you can do. And they said to me that I had to prove my Aboriginality because my last name wasn't recognised.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yep. And also that I was possibly too educated for that to come into the Aboriginal recruitment part of the public service.
What's that saying about you can never be too overdressed, too educated?
Yeah.
When you receive feedback like that, what were you feeling at the time?
Well, I got it in a letter, I think it was, and it was like, oh, can you? And I said, no, I'm not proving anything to anybody. After that, I was working at what used to be the Commonwealth Employment Service, job employment place, and I won a position through an interview, you know, with the Premier's Department. But I was like, welcome to the public service, Janine. But, yeah, that really threw me about me having to prove my Aboriginality. I wish I would have kept that letter because that is a part of my journey, you know, but back then you don't think of those things.
Again, I'm still trying to understand how you actually do that.
I honestly don't know because back then they never really had, like they do now with Aboriginal agencies that can provide. If you're a part of that nation or those areas, they can provide letters to say that you're known to the community, you're respected, you know, you're accepted, those sorts of things. But back then, why would you need to?
It's not like you can do the 23andMe, spit in the tube and send it off or something like that. That didn't exist in the 80s.
No, I still find those DNA things a bit weird today. But, yeah, just asking you how much of your body is Aboriginal and how much isn't. It was a different way of coming into the public sector world, but I didn't let that stop me.
There's this theme that's going on about having to prove at every step and having to show that excellence, but then also being too excellent and too educated. You could have given up a long time ago, Jen, and you could have said, well, stuff all this. I'm not actually going to jump through your hoops. Mm-hmm. Why did you continue with it?
I've always wanted to work with my people. And coming from a family that's had strong voices across Aboriginal issues, political areas, you know, advocacy, always. So I've come from a family that has taught us to look people in the eye and say what you need to. Be respectful, but say what you need to. I think learning from watching my uncles and aunties going through those sorts of things, and my grandfather and grandmother, just everybody in my family, I've been fortunate enough to have strong role models. There was no option to just say no, because I've always, like I said, I've always wanted to not save the world, because who can save the world, but just be another voice for our people.
The advocacy thing is really strong. We spoke last season with Dr. Tracy Westerman.
Oh, yeah.
And she said the same thing. It was the, well, if I don't stand up and say it, if I don't advocate for my people who don't always get the say, who's going to do it?
That's right.
So you start in the public sector. You're doing some work after eventually getting your stupid letter, proving who you are, being educated. And then you move into the Education Minister's Department, which is Dr. Carmen Lawrence.
Amazing.
Somebody else who we also got to speak with last season.
Oh, wow.
You're all connected here. It's really great.
It's crazy.
What was it like working with Carmen?
That was pretty mind-blowing. She actually comes from the town next door to my town.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Oh, you would have had great stories to share.
So, yeah, I said, you know, like she knew my family as well. I was in Perenjori, she was in Morawa. So that was, yeah, quite a, but I'd always admired watching her and said, oh, that would be really great to have the opportunity to work with her. So I went from the Premier's Department at the time of, I think it was around Peter Dowding. I started probably 6 months before she became Premier. So I saw that whole thing of her moving from being a minister, and she'd allow us to sit in on her interviews just to give us that experience. To see her move across to over east and into that bigger picture, it's just a shame she couldn't be supported enough to keep going. But that was quite inspirational.
She's a remarkable woman. And
yes,
this is late 80s, early 90s Australian politics. I don't know how much of it we can actually say has improved for women in politics, but to see that and be there at the most exciting time in her political career, and you're there in the office with her, is amazing.
And she was just a normal person, as you would say, you know, treated everybody the same, respectful, and just very intelligent. Just listening to her was just like, wow, it's great to have a woman's voice and a strong voice in Parliament. I think a lot of people could take a lot from that.
There's also something to be said about strong and powerful women working together as well, because you were there in that office at the same time, Janine. So I imagine it was like the unstoppable force.
Yeah, and again, knowing that she'd come from a little town next door to mine, it's like, well, people from little country towns are being successful and getting through. And probably in her ear and my mum's ear, that's hard for a woman to come through with a voice, because you're either chastised for being you're an aggressive or an angry woman, you know, but you're just being yourself, and you're also putting it out there that, you know, you've got a voice.
I want to talk a little bit about after the education minister and after working in Carmen Lawrence's office. Where were you next?
Where did I go? It's like 100 years ago. No, I went from Carmen's office, I went to another minister's office who sadly passed away a few years back. I was kept with the ministers for Aboriginal Affairs. I wanted to stay in that environment. And then from there, Jim McGuinty became the housing minister and Aboriginal Affairs. So I went and worked there, and got the opportunity to then go down to Department of Housing from his office, because I was going on maternity leave and I wanted to work in the Aboriginal housing. So I moved down there.
What was it that drew you to Aboriginal housing?
The lack of. The lack of housing, the homelessness, you know, people being put out of their houses or being evicted just simply for racial reasons. You know, you can't congregate more than two or three people in your yard or in your house, and God forbid that you would talk loud, laugh, maybe swear, there would be calls to the department. Oh, there's a group, there's a big lot of Aboriginal people congregating next door, and fearful, and, you know, just all that. But it was just family getting together and having a laugh. But, you know, they're shouting. So all of those sorts of things was like, hang on, they're being not given a voice themselves. They've got no room to put their story forward. So again, advocating.
As an Italian person with a very large and very loud family,
you get it.
If we had a phone call every time at a Christmas or a birthday or there's always a christening or something going on, it would be never ending.
Exactly.
That's exhausting.
And it's every day. It was people were being watched every day simply because they were Aboriginal. So we had a section within Department of Housing, which was Aboriginal housing, and we used to have customer support officers, which I was, and we used to go out and work with the Aboriginal families that were facing breaches for whatever reason and try and work them around to keep them in their houses.
There'll be people who say things, maybe it comes from a place of ignorance, maybe it comes from a place of arrogance, but they say, well, why do we need a separate sector for Aboriginal housing or Aboriginal health? Can you explain to those people and maybe just remind some of us listening why we actually do need to have individual people like yourself in that sector?
Because we don't get the same service. We're not treated the same quality of service. For some unknown reason, they tend to think it's okay to be disrespectful to an Aboriginal person or stereotype them to the point where they think, what's the point in helping them, because they'll only go back and do whatever they're doing. That's anybody.
It's also their choice. If people want to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. You're there to provide a service to the community, and Aboriginal people are a part of the community. We're First Nation people, you know, so if people could just acknowledge that in the first instance and remind themselves that we do have different ways of living, different laws, customs and traditions, just like you said, you're Italian, I'm sure you have many of those different traditions as well. So you need to cater. You've got to have a safe space, knowing that Aboriginal people are going to be treated the same, and it's not been happening.
Janine, I imagine that you've seen lots of wonderful things, but also a lot of hard things mm-hmm. as well. How do you get over that, or how do you move on?
You know, since probably being in health, I think it's really highlighted. I mean, housing was stressful in itself. I moved from there because I wanted to make a difference in health, in getting our women, especially the women, getting their health checks and things like that, making sure that they're educated enough to know their rights. And I think that was just driving me. At the end of the day, I don't know whether it was just the long drive home in the traffic or... But we also tried to embed whatever Aboriginal staff worked where you worked, we provided support to each other.
I imagine your family were a great source of support and strength too, yeah?
Yeah. Mum and Dad have always been really supportive. My uncles and aunties, amazing. Like I said, a lot of them were in the public eye and that as well. So watching them and how they, and all role models, you know, uncles and aunties extended, you know, that have been in those arenas, just keeping a hand on what's going on in our community and how it's affecting us in what ways. So to be really honest with you, back in those days, I think it was just resilience without knowing you had resilience. It was just the way of life. You had to keep going. You didn't have a way to go. You just fight another day.
Let's talk about health. What was the decision that was made to leave housing and move into health?
Sadly, like I said, I've always been for my people. And if it doesn't sit right with me, I don't care what your income is, what it is, but it's got to sit right with me and for my people. Coming towards the end of my career at housing, a lot of things were changing Commonwealth-wise. They were bringing in funding to the remote Aboriginal communities that if you were under a certain amount of population, you would have to move in to a funding space with another community, which they're different language groups, they're possibly different skin groups, and why should they? That is their land. And they were wanting us to go out and to talk to them and try and negotiate and see how we can get them to join in this other larger community so they can get maintenance. And I just said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to tell my people that they can't live on their part of their land, their traditional land. I said, no. So I started looking for another job. In that time, I had met a lady that had come across from the health department to do a breast screen talk. Women's session around breast screening for Aboriginal women. So this lady, Leanne Pilkington, who is now she's a sister to me, she was doing it and I was like, wow, that's awesome. That's powerful. Putting a message out, talking to Aboriginal women about their own health issues, why they should do this and that, educating them. And I said to her, if there's ever a job in that space, I would love to go out talking to our community. So during that next 6 months or so, I think it was, unfortunately, some colleagues and friends at the time had a sister that had passed away from cervical cancer. And I was like, whoa, that is crazy. You know, like, who would have thought? Never heard of that, you know, sort of thing. And then a job came up with the Cervical Cancer Prevention Program as the Aboriginal Health Promotion Officer. So I applied for it, and I don't know, I just had it in my head that I was going to get the job. And I went and had the interview and just felt, yeah. And then, yeah, they turned around and said, congratulations, you know, you've got the job. And I travelled across the state talking to women about their women's checks.
It's where you were meant to be.
Yes, wow. I believe so. That was the sign.
Just the difference in having to go out and talk to people on country and convince them to move in next door is a very different conversation to going out and talking to women about let's get your health in order.
Yeah, because we don't. Women in general, we just put ourselves second. Mm. And also there's a lot of cultural differences as well, and things like a lot of our women don't or are not comfortable with having male clinicians or doctors, and majority of them were male in the women's health space. So and it was something that our women were dying from, cervical cancer at that time, 3 times more likely to die from it than non-Aboriginal women. Our stats are always double or more in any aspect of our lives.
Despite being a small part of the entire country's population.
Exactly. Smallest part, but the highest representation, which is very sad.
We talked about the mortality rate before and you know, the significance of having 4 generations in your family. This was like the opportunity for you to make sure that, there are four generations and other families through your health promotion.
Yep. And that's why I'm so glad I went into that environment. Health promotion or prevention is the biggest area that is not given the respect, because, again, being honest, it's a money-making industry. If you help promote and recruit, advise them of their health rights and that and what they're entitled to, they get healthier lives, they're not going to need medication or keep going back to the doctor and that. So who's going to pay their bills? Who's going to? It's a business. So that's why I believe that prevention type health promotion or that whole area is just not given the respect that it needs, and the money, the funding, human resources in those areas. So we do with what we've got, but we get out there.
I suspect there would be people that wouldn't actually know that that is a job, what you were doing, health promotion, particularly Aboriginal health promotion. I reckon you'd be hard-pressed to find people that would be able to articulate what that actually means and why we need it.
Fortunately enough, we're starting to get more and more Aboriginal-funded programs around those sort of different determinants of health. And unfortunately, the horrible side of it is that it's when it's Commonwealth-funded, they're only sustainable for the time that you get the funding. So it could be 12 months, it could be 5 years, but that's it. You never get permanency in those roles. They're contracts, and that's where they need to start changing that and providing full-time permanent employment and embedding a better system in how we work with our people in that health promotion space.
When I think about those campaigns, the one that always comes to mind, and there's been a couple of different interpretations in my lifetime, is of the drinking alcohol while pregnant. That's the only one that comes to mind for me, though. And, you know, there could be a lot of reasons why that's the only one that I remember. But, you know, when you have the lived experience and when you're able to go out there and speak to other First Nations people, that's extremely invaluable.
And there's a lot of good programs now out in the Aboriginal health space, right across the Aboriginal health services or the community-controlled organisations. You know, they do get the funding to provide tackling Indigenous smoking. And a part of that would be advising women why smoking is not good while you're pregnant, just the same way as why drinking is not good for you at those stages and how it affects the baby. So it is, it's all about having the resources verbally and in your hands to see. And pictures obviously tells 1,000 words, so you can use pictures. You can talk in language, train in those areas to really provide the information, and again, it goes back to choice, but you're giving trustworthy options for them to take.
Just laying it all out.
Yep, honest, never hide anything, and you never promise anything. You just let them know how you can provide that support, and this is what it does.
Do you remember the first couple of times that you went out regionally and remotely and were talking to people in this new job?
The first... never was a public speaker. Still not, really.
You could have fooled me. You're doing a very good job.
And like I said, the lady I had mentioned earlier, Leanne Pilkington, would probably laugh her head off because I would have meltdowns before public speaking or doing a presentation.
You were way too calm and collected to be having public meltdowns.
Yeah, no, just beforehand she'd have to calm me down and, you know, Janine, it's okay, you speak good and you'll be okay. You know, and it was just like, no, I can't do this. But... I don't know. I guess I found my voice, or it's a part of being older as well. But I think those sorts of things, just we were able to do a grad diploma in Indigenous health promotion. So I thought that was a great opportunity to learn more.
The thing that you're known for, Janine, and one of the big reasons that you were inducted to the Hall of Fame in the health category this year is for all of the work that you've done, specifically with mothers wanting to birth on country, or if they can't do that, coming to Perth and making it culturally safe to do so.
Yep.
How did you get into that area of your career?
When I was working at a cervical cancer program, there was an Aboriginal maternal support unit being put together. They had some funding at King Edward Hospital, and I went over and did the health promotion in that area, so it was a brand new little unit. So I was there for a couple of years and helping going out and promoting those services. From there, I decided I would love to actually work within King Edward with the women. And an opportunity came around where they transferred my position across to King Edward. So I was the first Aboriginal health promotion officer in a hospital. And it was just my spot. Being born there, always wanted to work there because I wanted to be a midwife back in the day. But back then you had to be super fit and I had a back problem. So they said, no, sorry, you can't. So I never pursued it. So this was my way of coming back and helping. You know, yeah, I was in that job, health promotion job, for 12 years.
What year did you start at King Edward?
2009-10.
It took till 2009 to have a first in-house Aboriginal health promotion officer at a hospital. Is that what you said you were?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was breaking because usually it was either Aboriginal liaison officers that were going around and visiting. And not every hospital has an Aboriginal liaison officer. That's not a given, especially in the country areas. It's not a given. So it was something that we needed to provide. Like you said, women were coming to Perth, to birth, not by choice. So it wasn't a happy moment or a plan that they were coming. It was because they were considered to be high-risk pregnancies or they've had previous high-risk pregnancies or their own medical issues. But let's get it clear here that not every Aboriginal woman is a high-risk pregnancy. I know many women that have birthed at the family birth centre back in their own towns where they've got services, but there is a high majority and a lot of them are coming from the remote areas. So English is not really their first choice of language.
There's a lot to unpack there, and as somebody who's never given birth, and there'll be a section of our listenership that haven't and probably won't give birth. There's a lot going on when you're pregnant. There's a lot of things to consider. A lot of choices have to be made. A lot of safety factors have to be included as well. Mm-hmm. High risk or not, being an Aboriginal woman pregnant, what are some of the cultural considerations that you have going on while you're also pregnant?
Well, if you've got other children as well, you're going to have to separate yourself from them and come to Perth. So they're left either with their father or their grandparents or someone in the family. And they're down here on a strange country that they've never possibly been to before, never been in a city before. It's a foreign concept for them, and they have to actually put their trust in the system that they're going to get safely from wherever they're coming from to Perth, either by like flying or train or bus. You know, they get to the airport, they've got to trust a taxi driver to take them to the hospital. Someone they do not know or possibly have never met other nationalities. So they've got to hope that they're going to take them to the right space. And then they get there. So it's all this overwhelming and they might not have a support person with them. So they're on their own, which is another problem a lot of the times when women come through. It was just about providing that cultural safety, that space where they can know that there's Aboriginal women working at that hospital and they can come to us as we would come to them and introduce ourselves.
How many women do you reckon you've seen or supported in that job?
Oh, gosh, I never even put a number on that. So over 12, I mean, every week you would have at least 4 or 5 Aboriginal women, if not more, in the hospital. Whether it was for birthing or if it was for other women's health issues, and a lot of older ladies as well.
I'm gonna calculate it. So you reckon maybe 52-ish weeks of the year by 12. It's about 3,120 women, Janine. It's a lot of people.
And some of them come back with their next pregnancies and things like that. So it was nice to actually see. Oh, you're back again, you're having triplets. Oh, okay.
Good luck.
Yeah. But, yeah, we needed to get more Aboriginal women working there. It started to increase with the Aboriginal midwives, student midwives coming in, which was amazing to start seeing flowing through. In my role, I would provide not cultural training, just a cultural yarn with staff about how to engage with Aboriginal women and their families in that medical environment. Every new employee that came on board, we did talks with them and also provided them support too if we needed. But again, it was a lack of resources based around funding, high turnover of Aboriginal women coming through, but yet we still weren't meeting the marker in the employment space.
It seems like such a simple thing to do is to put you in a room with new employees and say, g'day, this is what to do, maybe consider these things, don't rush in and do this, so on and so forth. It seems like such a small act of recognition and acceptance. You mentioned there about maybe resources not always being there, funding not always available. Why are we still reluctant or maybe hesitant to just throw money at the wall for this? It seems like such a no-brainer.
I don't know. I think women's health in general is an issue of they don't take it seriously enough to provide the support that is needed in all aspects of a woman, whether it's social, emotional, physical. You know, it's just not enough. They don't listen to the women. They ask you the question, what is it that you really need? You tell them, but it still doesn't make any difference. So it's just like it's a Clayton's talk, a talk when, you know, a question you have when you don't have a question. It's not, I'm not listening really, I'm just stroking your ego sort of thing. And we're just very thankful that we've got so many strong women advocates out there. It's just empowering. And having non-Aboriginal champions as well, you really do cling on to those. And they sometimes feel the pressure, but we try to explain to them we need them to be in partnership with us to train and educate non-Aboriginal people in that space, because they're probably going to listen to them more than they're going to listen to us. But fortunately enough for me, the talks that I was doing there, that was with a lot of our staff that were from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. So they didn't have access to computers and things like that. So our way is to yarn. So I would just have those yarns with them and just do some myth busting as well. You know, like there's some really strange questions that come up. I always say no question is a stupid question. Unfortunately, in our space, we can pick out who is blatantly ignorant and rude and possibly that racist, or it's just someone that is just totally naive and never really had engaged with Aboriginal people before. So in those talks, you can usually see by body language who wants to be there and learn and who doesn't. The first couple of talks that I'd have would be about 5 to 10 people. Before I left, I was getting 30 and 40 coming through, and they would see you down the corridor and they'll say, Kaya, you know, hello. And it's just like, that's awesome. They're really embracing it. So it was just moving in a direction that I was liking.
They're really simple acts, Janine, but that's entirely from your influence and just from being there. And like you said, just having a yarn with people, that's massive.
Yeah, and I think I've always had a good communication with anybody, you know, you can have a good yarn with them. But, yeah, it's got to be safe for them just as much as safe for us as well. Yeah, there would be some conversations that were a bit robust, but at the end of the day, you agree to disagree. And thank you for bringing that to my attention, or if we can have a talk later and maybe come and have a look at some of our things. Come and involve yourself.
What are you doing now, Janine? Where are you working?
So after I left King Edward, during that time I was in King Edward, I'd actually won a Churchill Fellowship to travel across two countries to have a look at doula programs. So I don't know if you know what a doula is. It's a birth support worker. I think it's a Greek word that says, you know, mother's aid. And doulas, when you think of doulas, you really think of affluent women that have got, you know, very wealthy backgrounds,
yes,
and they have, you know, these sort of services available to them. So that's the generic word, I'm guessing. You know, it's the mainstream word. So while I was doing a Birthing on Country project at Nunkyura Research Institute at Murdoch, and out of that Birthing on Country project, I was like, oh, I might want to train as a doula, I think. So I went and investigated Perth courses. They weren't for me because there was no cultural aspect in it. It was very mainstream, but I wanted something that was more culturally open and bringing that sort of thing into it. So I didn't do it. And the researchers I was working with says, why don't you apply for a fellowship and go over to other countries and see what the First Nation people are doing there? Because I'd also started up a volunteer program
Of course you did.
In King Edward. That was another part of helping the women, you know, like creating a volunteer program for Aboriginal women. So with all of that going on, I went across to Canada for 4 weeks and met with First Nation women right across, went to a healing hospital, just talked to them about their programs and how they embed this support work for their pregnant women that also have to birth off their traditional country and go to the big cities. Very similar.
I was going to say, did you find that there were a lot of similarities, just yes. very simple acts of acknowledgement?
Yeah. And the distances that they have to travel, the language divide, and birthing off country away from their own traditional processes. So that was just probably the most amazing experience I've ever had. From there, I went down to New Mexico in America for 2 weeks in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, where they were looking at building a birthing centre. So I went and met with a lot of those women as well, and a midwife in Auckland. A Māori midwife. So now I've come back. I left King Edward and then moved into WA Country Health in 2019 after I'd come back from my trip. And I was there until 4 weeks ago. I was the Aboriginal Health Consultant for the Wheatbelt area. And from there I've moved now as a Senior Research Fellow at Nyangyura.
So we've got you right at the start of this new adventure. That's really yep. exciting.
Yep. And this is where I'm fortunate enough to be able to implement this doula program or birth navigators, whatever word we're going to come up with that resonates with different areas of WA. It's WA focused at this point in time. Over the years, I've been talking about it and a lot of Aboriginal women are like, sign me up, you know. It's another pathway as well to midwifery.
What a full circle moment of starting life and being rejected, I guess, by institution, being told you need to prove yourself, you're too educated to be part of this sector, to then working in it for so many years and now just starting your own institution and saying, well, you know, it was great to work in yours and I'm so thankful and I've gotten to meet so many people and learn so much, but now I actually need to start our own sector for it.
Yeah, and Nyangyura has provided that for me over the last 10 years with the birthing projects that I've been involved with them and learning to understand what an Aboriginal researcher is. We have so many researchers in our area that are not Aboriginal. And over the years, it's slowly growing, but we need more. I did not even think I would end up being an Aboriginal researcher. When I first started in the project, I said to one of my colleagues, I said, what is an Aboriginal researcher? You know, like, don't you have to have degrees and
things
like
that?
No,
you just get on Google.
And she turned around and she said, Janine, with a straight face, you are an Aboriginal researcher? I said, no, I'm not. I don't have the education. You know, like, I have not been to college or anything to do that. And she's like, you're working on an Aboriginal women's project. You're an Aboriginal woman. You're a researcher. Oh, okay.
You've been doing it, mate, for 30-odd years.
And that's the strength that this Nyangyura has come to now. It's now an institute for change. It's, you know, it's just run by an amazing woman, Rhonda Marriott, Professor Rhonda Marriott, and many other Aboriginal women and non-Aboriginal researchers. We're all going in the same direction, working towards the same goals of providing a better service and a journey for the woman.
What does Nyangyura mean?
Mother, son, or mother and son, you know, or the sun, the Mother Earth. Yep.
I love that.
Yeah, it was given the name by one of our Aboriginal elders and advisors. So it's we're blessed to still have elders that can provide us with language.
Before we wrap up, Janine, you mentioned that the Churchill Fellowship and there's been many accolades and highlights in your career. One that I want to touch on is the Women's Hall of Fame, inducted at the start of this year in 2022 in the health category. Take us back to the moment when you found out. What was going on in your head?
Oh, my gosh, this is hilarious. I still laugh when I don't know. So probably a year or two ago, one of the ladies that I was working with at Nyank on another project, she said she was going to nominate, and I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. Like, you know, I didn't get inducted back then, but COVID and everything hit. And then sometime last year, she mentioned something about, oh, are you okay with me putting your nomination back in again? I said, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, just flipped it off. I got an email. Congratulations. You have been selected as an inductee. And I was like, am I being punked?
Is this spam?
Yes. I was like, is this junk mail? Like, what am I doing here? Do I respond to it or is this computer going to blow up? Why would the Hall of Fame be sending me an email?
Delete.
Yeah. So I was like, so I think I wrote back to them and said, oh, thank you very much. Is this real? Like,
is this? No.
You know, I feel like I'm being punked or something. They just laughed. They were like, no, this is real. And then I had to keep it to myself for 3 odd weeks.
Oh, that's hard. And you've got a lot of family around, a lot of people you want to tell. That's too hard.
And I had to go and do, you know, photo shoots and do this and do that. And my mum would be like, where are you going on a Saturday? Or and I'm like, oh, I've just got an appointment. But you're all, you know, makeup up and got your hair done and you're looking a bit nice there. And I said, I look nice every day. No.
I've got a new doctor.
Yeah.
Got to impress them.
I wish. But yeah, so I had to do these lies. And I said to Gina Church, I'm like, oh, this is really, really hard. Couldn't tell anyone, not even the person that nominated me. So I was like, oh. So yeah, we did that. I think probably the most special moment leading up to getting the official inductee, one of the other inductees for this year was my phys ed teacher.
No way.
From high school.
Who was that?
Donna Cross.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yes. So when she walked up, and clearly she has not aged or looked any different to.
She looks wonderful.
Stunning. And she was an amazing phys ed teacher as well. Just beautiful, beautiful. We were fortunate to have two great phys ed teachers. But, yeah, when she walked up, I was like, no way. No way. So I walked up to her and she was like, oh, what?
What are the chances of the same year you're both inducted?
Exactly. And still to this day, I kind of think like professors, entrepreneurs, they've got their own organisations, companies, they travel the world, and here's Janine slotting in.
You're an Aboriginal researcher. Don't even.
Thank you. But that was amazing. And we had photos to, you know, taken, and it was just like, absolutely amazing. I rung all my friends up from school and I was like, you wouldn't believe. I said, she looks younger than me. Oh, my God. Beautiful inside and out. So that was really special. But all the inductees were amazing and we were allowed to take family, but I didn't want to tell them.
So who did you bring?
So I could take two people. So I took mum and my son. I apologised to my dad, but I said, if there's another, I said, but, you know, that's just how I feel. And he's like, yeah, I don't like public stuff anyway. They thought we were just going to dinner for an event, a women's event sort of thing. So we got to the government house and it still didn't register with them and everyone's coming up, Janine, blah, 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 you need to do this, this. We sat down, they started doing the speeches and then started calling and my son looked at me and he said, Mum, why are you nervous? I said, oh, I've got to do a speech. And then I went, oh, okay. He's like, okay. Mum's sitting there oblivious to what's going on, just soaking it all up, you know. And my son's like, oh, my God. I said, oh, surprise. When I got up on the podium, I was like, oh, Mum, by the way, I'm one of these people, surprise. She's like, how did you not? I said, I wasn't allowed to tell anybody. But the looks on their faces, it was priceless. You know, there was tears and proudness and it was just really, and they were like, how could you just keep that from us? You could have told us we were coming to this sort of environment. But no, I wouldn't be where I am today without my family, especially, you know, raising a son on my own with my family support. But very proud of him. He's 30 and he's given me my first grandchild. child. Yes, finally. No. So I'm in that next phase now of being a grandmother and being able to spoil them rotten and then give them back to the parents.
Hype them up on sugar them, and off you go.
Yeah. So it's just been a whirlwind. I did a talk at the launch of the nominations at Parliament House. And in that one there, I said that whilst I'm still not used to public speaking, I'm kind of getting used to it a bit more now. But this Hall of Fame, to me, has just given me a voice that I can really put out there, not just for Aboriginal women, but for women in general on so many different aspects. And I'm going to use it. So that's what I said to them and thanked them for allowing me to be a part of that. And there's so many Aboriginal women that have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's amazing.
I think we're going to end it there, Janine.
Yep.
That was a really lovely place to end. Before I do let you go, though, this is podcasted, but we also put it on the radio.
Okay.
So we want to ask you for one of your favourite songs to play with it. I'm sorry to put you on the spot. Do you have even just an artist that you love, and we'll pick a song for you?
Oh, my gosh. I honestly am stumped. I don't even, I'm sitting here thinking, is there any woman songs that I resonate with?
Oh, yeah.
I do like Archie Roach, anything around him. Then from there, I love Bob Marley, his take on life. Love Jessica Mauboy, an Australian Aboriginal girl that's just succeeded in many areas. So, anything from her is great.
What about we do an Archie Roach, Ruby Hunter?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that sounds great. They've left a lifetime of memories, and fortunately for us, they're recorded.
How lucky are we? We still get to celebrate it all.
Yeah. And, back in the day, they didn't have recording things, so you can't hear your loved ones gone.
Mm.
You can't hear their voices anymore, whereas our kids today will always have. When someone passes on in the family, they have that beauty of having her keep hearing their voices.
Yeah.
And I think Archie and Ruby is probably a good fitting. I'm just glad I got to see him when he came to Perth for different events. To actually see him live was pretty surreal.
Yeah.
And just their plight and their struggles and just amazing. And I think just hats off to all of our Aboriginal leaders in those different areas, especially in the acting field, because that was pretty hard to get through.
Yeah, you talk about resilience before.
Mm-hmm.
There it
exactly,
is.
Yeah. Exactly that. So all we can do now and in the future is just keep building our youth up and to be having their voices with comfort, strength.
Thanks to Janine Glidden and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Theme music is an original composition by Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTR FM podcast series about women in the WA Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Wadjuk Noongar Budja. RTR FM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast is made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Next week, we hear from the woman who is the first female president of the African community of WA.